Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. We're recording this on January 26, 2017, and you're listening to episode 17. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. We'd really like one review. Or wherever you found this podcast, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian.
We're recording this just shy of 1 week into Trump's term. On a scale of one to just terrific, how great is America?
I did a throwback Thursday today on Twitter to literally any time when fascism wasn't on the rise. And that's why I think it's time to launch into our first segment, which is just, it's not the size of the crowd that matters, it's just how you use it. We haven't touched on American politics for a few weeks, and part of that has been there's lots of stuff going on in Canada, and there definitely is still now. The other part is there's just such a flood of shit flying at us from the States. It's just like a monkey flinging feces war, only the monkey flinging the feces is in the White House and is appointing terrible people everywhere, and literally every day is like a new dystopian young adult novel of horror. And so I don't even know where to start. So yeah. How do we keep up?
And that's always been the problem I keep running into, is every time I think America has dug as deep down as it can go, it somehow manages to find a way to dig just a little deeper, and something even more bizarre or outrageous happens.
Like, some of these things are familiar. The shuttering of scientists and government officials that get gag rules on them and they can't speak out. The sort of treatment of the press. I know I've listened to a lot of journalists in Canada talk about how it was very similar to when Harper came in, and he sort of had a huge disdain for the media once he came into power. When he was in opposition, he loved the media because he could get attention and try to build his brand and build the Conservative Party. But once he became prime minister, he just sort of stopped doing press conferences. He did one, didn't like it, stopped doing them. And journalists went, well, I guess access journalism is dead. But what it really ended up being was all political journalism kind of died in Canada. It just sort of resorted to punditry, which is fine that we do. We're the amateurs not being paid. But if all CBC and the National Post and everyone is just running editorials and analysis, you have to have someone to actually break a story. So there is, I know, some effort on big newspapers like Washington Post and the New York Times to look into refunding journalism. I think the New York Times is hiring a lot of local journalists again, finally. But I'm skeptical that it'll work. I'm cynical, maybe. Then beyond that sort of similarity with the Harper regime, this is, I'm not going to say they're equivalent in any way. People called Harper dictatorial or fascist or terrible things, but we're now at the level where, you know, Trump is signing executive orders to build his wall. He's signing orders to effectively end immigration from Muslim countries, except Saudi Arabia, interestingly. Basically, the Muslim countries where the terrorists aren't coming from.
And where he doesn't have business interests in.
Exactly. He's creating, surprisingly, a registry that's just going to, like, list accusations and crimes. It's not really clear that immigrants commit. It stops being Godwin's law when the analogies are almost identical. Godwin's law being that any internet debate will inevitably fall to references to Hitler. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. We wrote down a list of 30-odd things that are terrible that have happened in the last 5 days. Well, and the Women's March, which was awesome. But it shouldn't have to happen. You know, you shouldn't have to have the world's largest protest happen because one of the most terrible people has ever been elected president.
Yeah, it's definitely been unprecedented, or as Trump once tweeted, unprecedented, what we're seeing in the States. And what really has jumped out to me the most is, besides all the questionable policy decisions he's made, and there's a lot, it's just the disdain for the basic norms of the U.S. system of government. Yeah, you can debate the merits of whether or not a wall is going to be an effective means of reducing illegal immigration, but what you can't debate is whether or not 1.5 million people showed up to Washington on inauguration day. You know, Trump has been on, like, 6 days now of constantly going on and on about how he had the biggest inauguration ever, despite the fact that very clearly that was not the case. You can look at pictures side by side of other inaugurations with bigger crowd, and it's not, you know, five people difference. We're talking couple city blocks worth of people just milling about.
This is a really important point to sort of hammer in on, is more than anything, it's just the literal lies coming out of the White House, coming out of the senior staff, and just the attempts to distort the past, to rewrite history as a way to build up his ego. I read a nice piece that was sort of pointing out that one of the tricks authoritarians use is to tell you the honest truth about what they're going to do and lie about the past, whereas the media is generally expecting politicians to do the opposite, to say what's happened, but lie about the future. Say, oh, when I get into power, I'm going to do this and this, but then I'll break my promises. That's what normally happens. And so when someone lies about the past and tells the truth about future, the media doesn't know what to do.
Yes, and you know, Trump supporters have pointed out that, you know, other people have lied in the White House before. You know, it's not uncommon for, in fact, that's kind of the job of the press secretary, is to apply a certain amount of spin and misdirection. But what really separates this is just the sheer audacity of such easily verifiable facts being blatantly misreported by the press secretary, and among others. This is just such an obvious thing where even, you know, a minute or two of Googling show you what the difference is. And this isn't, you know, an alternate take on a certain set of facts. You know, this isn't where, you know, opinions diverge. This is about the implications. This is a clear and blatant, just flat-out lie. And the fact that it hasn't just been said and been repeated, but it's been doubling down and constantly being hammered again and again by the president, who seems unable to move past it. And it's a little weird. Like, I thought during the primaries, when they'd gone to a bit of a dick-measuring contest on a debate stage...
A literal one.
Nearly literal one. A heavily implied dick-measuring contest. I thought that was kind of weird, but, you know, it's heat of a debate in the middle of a contentious primary, whatever. But we're on day six of Trump being size obsessed here. Like, it's getting to be just a little weird about the whole thing.
I mean, it definitely plays into his vanity and his insecurities almost, and his need to be the best and the biggest, even when it's clearly not. I think the other thing going on here is you have just classic abuser tactics, which is that sort of keep lying to people, keep telling them, hit you because I love you, and it's all this bullshit that's meant to try to keep things together when they're terrible and you need a fast break from this terrible situation. Unfortunately, America's kind of stuck with him for 4 years, maybe less if he gets impeached. It's frustrating, and I think he's almost just going to beat the press down on every single issue by just continuing to lie. He's got his base that clearly doesn't care about facts. They care about feelings, they care about passion and emotion, and he can point to things he's doing. He can even just rewrite history already by saying, look, the economy is actually pretty good, it's because I'm in office, when in reality, all of that was the last 8 years of sort of fixing the recession. Crime is at its lowest, he can now claim, but not because of anything he's done, because of sort of long-term trends and ever-evolving policy that's starting to tackle some of these systemic issues, but he's just going to rewrite history and take credit for literally everything he can. And I just don't know how to combat that, and it scares me.
Yeah, it's definitely concerning, and what I think is being kind of the bigger long-run story of the past year, and a bit particularly, is kind of the erosion of kind of the institutions and the norms of civil society and how, you know, politics and our government function, and everything we've seen in the past 6 days is just the continuation of that. And it's been really striking just how much of a new path Trump is treading here. Anytime there's been a contentious election in the past, the inauguration speech is all about bringing America together, healing the divisions. Yeah, that was the theme of Bush's 2000 address after a very contentious presidential election. His one was about he's going to be the president for all Americans, even the majority that didn't vote for him. Trump's speech, on the other hand, it was basically, I'm going to be the president for my voters and nobody else. And we're seeing that kind of again and again, and basically everything he's doing is that it's about Trump, the Trump team, and basically nothing else.
None of this is that surprising based on how he ran and the things he said. I think people have this idea that you should either take him literally but not seriously, or seriously but not literally. And I think the mistake is we need to do both. He says a lot of scary things, and he's following through as much as he can on those, as quick as he can. And I think that's the one thing that shocked a lot of people is, oh, he'll build a wall. Well, he'll get to that eventually. That's going to be one of the first executive orders he's going to sign to try to get going. The speed at which it's sort of all happening, I think, is just like shocking and awing people. And that's frustratingly a good tactic, I guess, if you want to ram through authoritarianism or really upset the system or really overthrow all those norms. It's sort of following the best playbook he can, which is throw so much out there that there's no like single point that everyone can rally against. They can't all get together and protest the wall. They can't get together and protest the appointment of Betsy DeVos to education secretary. There's so many battles happening all at once. It's a political blitzkrieg, almost.
Yes, but at the same time, this is mostly being all executive orders that he's been signing. He's very much been using the bully pulpit of the presidency, and what's going to be interesting to watch is how he handles it when he can't run everything through the Oval Office. Now, to get these policy objectives, he's going to have to get Congress on side and get stuff through the legislature. Killing Obamacare, yeah, he signed that executive order early on, but that's still pretty limited in what he can do. Any little bit of discretion there is in the law, yeah, he can take advantage of that, but he can't actually change the law. And same thing with this wall. Estimates range between, I think, 10 to 30 billion for the wall. And that's not money Trump can just will into existence. He has to go through the normal budgeting process for it, and that means fights on the floor of Congress and in the back halls and everything. And this sort of bluster to the media isn't the same thing as rallying votes, whipping votes, all the kind of drudgery of the legislative process. And from what we've seen of Trump so far, he's shockingly ignorant. And not just him, the general approach of that administration as a whole has been rather ignorant of how government functions, the processes of government, just the norms of government too. And that, I think, is going to be where we start to see the test, is what happens when he has to work outside of the powers of the Oval Office.
So far, I'm not very optimistic just on how the senior Republican leadership has effectively rolled over. Marco Rubio doesn't seem to be putting up more than a few words of token defense until it's like, all right, well, let's approve Rex Tillerson to Secretary of State, even though he's got clear conflicts of interest with Russia and is effectively the anti-Republican, anti-Democrat too, just like the anti-establishment. There's no way they should be rubber stamping these people through. I know they're taking a bit more time than they usually would, but there's not much indication that any of his picks are going to be rejected, maybe out of fear that he'll just pick someone worse. But those feel like hills to start fighting on if you're the Republican Party and you want to sort of preserve some semblance of normalcy in Washington.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a challenge, and that's what we're going to have to be watching for. And the Republicans haven't had a huge amount of political courage in recent years. So early on, I think there's definitely going to be some issues there. And really, the ball's in the Democrats' court on this one. They need to start finding a way to peel off Republicans. They have a bare majority in the Senate. You know, peel off one or two Republicans and you can basically kill something in the Senate. The House is a little more complicated, but you know, they need to start finding Republicans who won their seat by a larger margin than Trump won in their district, where they're more popular than Trump, where there's a division there, and where if they can make the case to those Republicans that siding with Trump is going to drag them down, and I think as more of the scandals that have been brewing in the background come to the front, that's going to be easier and easier to do as people suddenly wake up to the realization of what getting rid of the ACA actually means. You know, there's been quite a few people who wanted to get rid of Obamacare when it was a theoretical thing, but now that's actually happening, are starting to realize that, oh, crap, the ACA is what gives me my health care, and so it's been a few kind of shocking stories of people who didn't realize they were the same thing. That's the sort of areas where the Democrats need to really start taking charge and trying to find ways to peel off those Republicans, and there's already a split within the Republican Party on how to deal with the getting rid of the ACA. There's the repeal, the repeal and replace, the repeal and delay. So there's those divisions that can be exploited. And the Democrats need to start really kind of exploiting that and chipping away at that. And on the foreign policy side, Trump hasn't done much on kind of the security angle yet. But there's a good chance he can probably peel off some of the Russia hawks in the Republican Party on that. There's going to be kind of the Republicans who care a lot about free trade. Some of those you can probably peel off. So there are divisions between Trump and the Republican Party that can start to peel apart. And it just takes a skill and courage to actually split those open without also fracturing the Democrats. And that's where I think the trade area is going to be the hardest to do, is because there's not exactly a lot of love for many of those trade deals among some of the Democrats, too. So that one's probably going to be a little harder than the Russia issue to break apart.
Well, while we're talking about trade deals, maybe it's a good time to pivot and sort of look at what all of this is meaning for Canada right now. So what are the implications? I know one of the things Trump approved in the last week, or started to really push his weight behind, was the Keystone XL pipeline. That looked all but dead. What was really interesting was sort of the response by the Trudeau government and the Alberta NDP Rachel Notley government. Both of these politicians are now on the pro Keystone XL pipeline. They're cheering for it, and they're getting sort of the flack from their base on it. And it puts it in this really weird realm where, on a few other issues, you have Canadian politicians trying to figure out how to deal with Trump, because they have issues like this, which that would be normally tricky. But now you also have the issue where if you are too critical of Trump, maybe you're threatening Canadian jobs, as one NDP commentator wrote in the Taii about Christy Clark's statements about Donald Trump and calling him disgraceful. So it's this weird balance that the Canadian politicians are trying to take of, do we speak out against his rhetoric, or does that risk our own economy? And Mulcair is definitely taking the stronger, Trump's terrible, let's condemn everything he does, which, given his base, is probably a good play.
Well, for that, it really depends which politician and where they sit. It's one thing for Thomas Mulcair, leader of the third party, who he really has nothing to lose from being critical of Trump. His base doesn't like Trump, and not only that, he's the leader of the third party.
The interim leader
of the third party. Nothing he says is really going to have any significant diplomatic repercussions. It's basically for domestic consumption only. Trump's not likely to pay attention or notice. It only makes sense to be loud and just drum up the passions in the base and your supporters and the people who don't like Trump. There's basically only upside for the opposition leaders, especially the ones in third parties who aren't really contesting power seriously in upcoming elections. On the other side, you have people in power right now, and yeah, of course they are going to be walking a finer line. And on Keystone, you know, no Canadian Prime Minister is going to basically say no to another country wanting to take our product. It's just not going to happen. And it's one thing to, you know, not push for it when it was still trying to get approval, but now that it has approval, it's unlikely you're going to see any prime minister of really any party ever come out strong against exporting goods to other countries. And on the NDP side, there's always been kind of this, you know, we want to do everything in Canada, value-added jobs here, that even when there was never really a business case for them, and that's basically what's, I think, happened with the Alberta NDP, is they're not willing to spend money on to build a government-owned refinery in Canada, and there isn't a business case for anyone in the private sector to do it, so might as well sell oil to where it is economical to refine it.
On the other hand, we have seen some stronger words from a couple of the premiers. You can make the case that Trump's not going to care about the premier of a Canadian province, and that's probably true to some extent. But I think Clark's called out that kind of culture, which is admirable. I think Kathleen Wynne also has. So you have two premiers of two of Canada's larger provinces who have a lot of trade with the U.S., and BC is at risk of another softwood lumber dispute coming up real quick. Ontario does a lot of manufacturing and auto parts across the border, so they need to make sure that if NAFTA or North American trade deals are looked at, that they keep access very easy. But then I think they both know that their bases are more kind of centrist and don't want that kind of rhetoric polluting Canadian discourse. And so they're trying to take strong stands. So you have Kathleen Wynne oddly sort of entering the Conservative Party of Canada leadership race, criticizing Kevin O'Leary personally, when premiers usually stay out of federal politics, except when it's to deal with the government. But
and it's a weird thing to do, too, because it's only going to help Kevin O'Leary. Kathleen Wynne is really unpopular, and most of Ontario doesn't like her, and the Conservatives in Ontario really don't like her, and getting in a feud with the very unpopular Liberal premier is only going to help Kevin O'Leary in the Conservative leadership race.
There's the theory that maybe that's what she wants, because a further right Conservative Party makes Liberals look more reasonable, and what happens at the federal level sometimes mirrors some of the provinces.
We saw how well that worked out for Hillary's team. It's a risky play, especially in light of current events.
Yeah, I don't support that plan. It's a bad strategy, because every government will eventually lose. And I think if you do lose, you don't want the pendulum to swing so far. Maybe you do, because then it won't be there for long, and then it'll come back to you, but playing with a very dangerous football then, or whatever analogy I'm using, norms can break down really fast, and the damage being done in the States right now, I don't know how long it will take to bring the needle back to improving the situation for most Americans instead of the narrow few. So that brings us, of course, to the challenge of the Canadian Trump, which we've talked about a few times, especially in regards to the Conservative Party of leadership race. This week we have Pierre Lemieux releasing his anti-political correctness rants and his policy that he'll pull political correctness out of the Canadian government, as though that's a thing. He wants to appoint people to really just troll through the laws and policies and I guess find anything that promotes human rights or that tries to promote equality. But it's playing into this same kind of rhetoric that Kelly Leach has been on for a long time, that Kevin O'Leary is using at times, especially with his media stardom. And it terrifies me. It's all about dividing us and really just trying to say everything is good, we shouldn't try to work to make the world any better. It's not like Lemieux has high chances of winning the leadership race. I don't think anyone, we've never even really talked about him prior to this. I think perhaps this is just one of those ways to get some attention.
Yeah, he's almost certainly going to end up as an also-ran on this leadership race right now. I do think the bigger concern is going to be the Kelly Leach and, to a lesser extent, Kevin O'Leary. O'Leary seems much more just an opportunist and I guess a bit in the Trump mold, although those comparisons I think are a little overdone, is that really does seem willing to kind of say anything to try and get elected. Just the other day he actually said he wasn't a capitalist. The guy who is a venture capitalist, where it's literally in the name of his job description.
It's only half the job description, to be fair.
Yeah, but unless it's preceded with ante, it's going to be a little hard to sell that. So yeah, O'Leary seems much more of a, I'll say anything to get elected, and kind of just pure opportunist. And to a certain extent, Kelly Leach is as well. She's basically the least convincing anti-lead of all time. Or I should say Dr. Kelly Leach is the least convincing anti-lead of all time. But there's definitely, I think, a concern that those sentiments are starting to take hold in parts of Canada. And it's not helped by outlets like Rebel Media that almost fell in the Breitbart model of trying to stir up a lot of dissatisfaction among the populist right.
Well, they absolutely are. And even in their own words, they're talking about, oh, we're Breitbart North, essentially. The thing that terrifies me a lot about that is Levant, who is Jewish, but apparently doesn't get that Nazis don't like Jews, is starting to use Nazi-esque terms like the word they had for lying press, Lügenpresse, I believe, to try to call the mainstream media out. And he uses it with probably a sense of provocation, but also...
I think everything... Levant does this with a sense of provocation.
And this is a guy who's been convicted multiple times in court of libel, where the judges have ruled that he has a reckless disregard for the truth, and yet he's still building his little media empire to try to bring a lot of that hatred and vitriol north. The one thing that's encouraging me, actually, is Ipsos put out a poll today looking at how different Conservative Party leadership candidates would do against Trudeau and the NDP right now. They looked at Kevin O'Leary. He potentially would tie the Liberals at 37-38%. Bernier at the helm, the Conservatives would only get 28%, and Kelly Leach, they'd only get 26%. So it seems like it's either just the name recognition that's boosting Kevin O'Leary, or people actually reject Kelly Leach a bit, pushing her numbers down.
It's probably a bit of both. You know, O'Leary basically has no policies, except he seems to be against the carbon tax, against Justin Trudeau, and in favor of corporate welfare. But beyond those kind of three sort of policy positions, if you can call them that, there kind of really isn't much to him besides he's loud, angry, and kind of well-known. And so I think this is the polls definitely reflecting kind of the celebrity aspect of it, too. And I wouldn't read too much into it, in large part because the leader of the opposition kind of grants celebrity on to whoever occupies the position. And you know, I didn't know who Tom Mulcair was in 2011, really, and that certainly has changed. It's one of those things that merely by becoming leader of the opposition, you get celebrity a certain level of celebrity, you get well-known, you know, you get a serious look by most Canadians come election time, and 3 years from an election with a bunch of people who aren't particularly well-known outside of conservative circles, of course you're not going to have a good matchup with a very popular, very well-known prime minister. It's just not all that likely to show up in the polling at this far out, nor is it going to be that predictive. Or there's definitely been a concern that these sort of sentiments might be taking roost in Canada, and some of the conservative leadership contenders have definitely made noises in that direction. But what is kind of reassuring to me is that I've actually had a couple friends who aren't particularly politically active, who I suppose could be described as pays attention but aren't particularly engaged, that either contacted me or kind of... made noises that, you know, they're either joining or considering joining a party to vote in the leadership races. And what has happened in the past year has definitely kind of brought forward, I think, a renewed sense of engagement with the political system.
That angle of getting involved in political parties has been sorely missing for a long time. Partisanship is viewed as such a negative and dirty word. But in Canada especially, where we don't have open primaries, the only way to have a guaranteed effect on party policy is to get involved in the party. You can do all you want with think tanks and activist groups like Lead Now or whatever charity represents your cause, and you absolutely should. But at the end of the day, it's the people that vote for the leader. It's the people who go to convention, get involved at their electoral district association, and who really push that kind of grassroots level through that make a difference. It's very frustrating at that level because you don't actually make that much of a difference. But if enough people start pushing it and say go to a Chong instead of a O'Leary, that will have a huge effect on the Conservative Party of Canada leadership race, especially the way it's balanced. If you live in one of the non-conservative ridings, you have a better chance of having your voice heard. So that's all the more reason for people to get involved. Or if you don't like the Conservatives, get involved in the NDP or Liberals and push them to have stronger voices forward, ones who you think represent.
Get involved with a party and try and lead it in the direction they want to see it go and kind of nudge it that way. Particularly if, say, you care a lot about climate change, for example, I seriously think about, say, joining the Conservatives and voting for Michael Chong as because he is running on part of that as engaging on the environmental file. And you're going to get, I think, a lot more bang for your buck by bringing a party that was formerly in opposition on side on it than you will by, you know, making the Greens or the NDP slightly louder on a message they've already been kind of banging the drum on for years now. And we briefly mentioned the Women's March at the start of the segment, and it's definitely reassuring to see that large turnout, but I don't think it's going to be as beneficial as joining up with a party, voting both, you know, in leadership races and in general elections, by-elections, because that's really what makes the difference, is voting and the kind of signal that voting sends. And, you know, as great as the turnout was, I'm not just going to convince many Republicans to change their policies, because they probably looked out the window and saw, oh, that's a lot of Democrats out there. And if they're not worried about losing their jobs from backing those policies, they're not likely to change tact. And if anything, it's more important to win over the median voter, the person who, you know, gave Trump a shot but starting to have second thoughts, and have, you know, getting them engaged it's going to pay greater dividends than getting a bunch of like-minded people out marching.
You're right on the point there, where I think 538 did a great analysis, and they figured out that most of the marchers, a significant proportion, lived in New York and California, and the sort of states where Hillary Clinton did really well and sort of ran up the scoreboard. There were marches across the country, though. There was marches in Canada and around the world, even. And it's not mutually exclusive with all the other activism that you talked about. That's vitally important. I think what this march does is allows people to come together and start thinking about this, and that's what helps trigger them to get engaged in those other ways. And I'm seeing some of that happening, and hopefully lots more and more happens. The one thing that really inspires me is that the last time there was a march of this scale was against the Iraq War back in 2003. Well, that didn't stop America or Britain from going in. I think that gave a lot of fuel to the activist to push on the Chrétien government, and that gave him the moral authority to say no when otherwise Canada probably would have just gone along.
It can be a useful place for politicians who are inclined but worried about the optics of something. It can give them a lot of political cover, and for that respect, it may actually be more useful in Canada, the marches, than it will be in the U.S., because with the current setup of the Congress and Senate, they're Republican majorities, and I doubt this march is going to give them that cover. It needs to be the "we're afraid of losing our jobs" sort of political pushback, and there's definitely a symbolic victory from the march. I'm not sure it achieved that, and specifically, it wasn't really set out to do that, but I think in terms of dissuading the current power holders in Washington from furthering their agenda, it hasn't done much on that front.
And of course, don't punch Nazis, unless it makes you feel good. But that's an entirely separate debate that we'll just leave out there. Let's switch gears entirely now and go into our second segment, which is if you ask stupid questions, you're going to get stupid answers. As we remarked back in December, the government launched its mydemocracy.ca survey with Vox Pop Labs that was meant to engage Canadians who hadn't been engaged by the multi-month cross-Canada tour of the Electoral Reform Committee and find out not what voting system we wanted, but just what are our values that we appreciate around voting. And as we noted at the time, there was widespread mockery and condemnation of these questions, which unsurprisingly gave kind of meaningless answers, it seems.
Yeah, the answers that we got were basically exactly what you'd expect people would answer questions that skewed as. The one that I think we put most of our focus on and I think condemned the loudest was the questions about the downsides of the proportional systems, the ones that, you know, they introduce instability in the system or they allow extremist parties and whatnot. And unsurprisingly, that's kind of what the results of the survey found. Or the concerns about the ballots being too complicated. Unsurprisingly, they found that people wanted a simple balloting system. Overall, this report I just don't think was all that useful. We didn't really learn a huge amount. They never really addressed how skewed the format of the questions were. Basically seems to confirm everything the Liberals more or less wanted, and from the looks of it, skewed the questions to lead them that way. And there just doesn't seem to be a huge amount this whole exercise has given us that's useful going forward.
Yeah, when the guy from Vox Pop Labs, the firm that conducted the survey, is giving quotes to CBC that say things like, "Many Canadians simultaneously hold preferences for various attributes that are commonly associated with different families of electoral systems." What he's basically saying is, this is a mess, and there's nowhere to really go with this because people like all kinds of different things, so there's no one system that's going to satisfy everyone, which is the perfect kind of answer you want if you want to do nothing, I think.
Exactly. This allows the Liberals to punt on the issue and kind of ignore it, throw up their hands, say, no, it's complicated, Canadians are divided, you know, they kind of satisfied with the system, there's a lot of different concerns about moving in different directions. Yeah, it's not going to be something we're going to pursue very hard going forward.
It was definitely interesting to at least see how different groups did try to spin it, though. Fair Vote Canada did put a press release up on their Facebook talking about how the report and a lot of the media failed to really delve at the numbers. The sort of executive summary glossed over, say, that 70% of people said several parties should have to collectively agree before a decision is made, while only 30% want sort of a dictatorial one party makes a decision. A lot of the numbers showed this sort of strong support for a collaborative, multi-party approach, even if it takes longer, which is very sympathetic to a proportional system. But as you say, when you have all those sort of downsides in there, of course people are going to say, downsides are downsides and upsides are upsides, so you don't learn anything, and it's just a big waste of money and time.
Even more part of the problem is, where were the upsides in the questions? They all highlighted the problems with new systems, didn't highlight any of the problems with the existing system in the wording of the questions. You kind of had to fill that in on your own from your experience with the current system, but, you know, they're happy to supply you with downsides of other systems.
What I think the government was hoping to get out of this was that everyone in Canada would be an innovator, or whatever their bullshit categories were, that everyone would sort of fit into one of these five categories, or at least most people, that then we could say, look, there's a consensus that we should head in this direction, and that they could use to then define a form of proportional representation that would work. But even if they didn't purposely skew the questions, they're framed in such a way that you're going to get people who say exactly what they said, which is, downsides are bad and upsides are good and people should get along, but things should be simple. And that doesn't fit the nice, neat little box. So it's just, what was the point of this is what I'm left with. What is the point?
It really seems to be a political tool to kind of allow the liberals to kind of work around having to implement their promise. As we said at the time when we first saw the survey questions, it would be much better to A, write them in a much more neutral fashion, and B, put some of the, you know, values, questions and whatnot in there, but actually have some of the alternate systems, gauge people's knowledge, interests in those systems, what they liked about it, what they don't, have a basic explainer on what mismember proportional, what single transferable vote is, ask, do you like this about this system, do you not, how overall do you like it? And if they'd included that with some of the other ones, it wouldn't be such a concern. This was the sort of thing they should have, if they are going to do these kind of broad overview topics, it should be what you do right at the start of the process and not after the end. So overall, there just isn't all that much we gain from it. Although there was one thing that did stand out to me is that a lot of people want to relax the party discipline in Canada. That was a rather overwhelming result with 51% at a strong degree and 32% at a somewhat degree on MP should represent the interest of their constituents, even if it means going against their party, which I think indicates kind of the annoyance with people have with the leader-centric model that we got in Canada. And it's also interesting that that's kind of what Michael Chong's been running on his Democrat reform side, and hasn't so far seemed to have got a lot of traction, but it could be the sort of thing that, you know, if he is successful in the leadership, really a lot of people will latch on to.
It was something he did a lot when he was an MP as well. He put forward some great bills on that.
Yes, so this isn't just a, you know, I'm running for office thing. This is kind of a long-standing policy preference of his that he's been trying to push through for quite a while.
Unsurprisingly, the report also found 90% of Canadians want some kind of limit on election campaigns. It is sort of an inevitable result after you have our longest election campaign in history, or one of our longest. What's also interesting is a slim majority, 53%, opposed mandatory voting. Majority of Canadians, 66%, don't want to lower the voting age, and that's kind of disappointing to me. I think there are strong merits to having people 16, 17 years old eligible to vote, or at very least get them registered to vote so that they're voting when they turn 18. And the online voting question left unclear results that were mostly dependent on how secure it could be made, which is the inevitable, I guess, unsurprising result. But beyond those questions, which were never really the core of the Liberals' promise. The Liberals' promise was 2015 is the last first-past-the-post election. Time is ticking, and now they have a survey that doesn't tell them anything other than opinions are divided, and so they can really just kick this further down the field. What I'm also actually not super disappointed by, but I was promised it, and now it's not there. The one thing they talked about when they launched this website is they were collecting all this demographic info so that when it was done, they would have an interactive site where you could compare yourself to everyone else and do all these data visualizations and things. Instead, we get a long standard government style report on Canada.ca that goes through all of this, but we don't get the engagement tool unless I haven't found it. It's not on mydemocracy.ca anymore. So you disappointed me, Vox Pop.
Overall, I'd say this has largely been a failure on everything but the pure political gamesmanship for the Liberals. It's been a useless survey, wastes a whole bunch of time, money, gets us no closer to electoral reform, doesn't even provide that much useful insight on where Canadians are.
All right, well, we're running fairly long today, but I think it's been good. So let's churn and just close off with a few of our sort of quick take stories. First up, the sort of interesting federalism news is that there's possibly going to be a new internal trade deal to break down some of the barriers people don't even realize we have between provinces, because it can actually be really difficult for a business operating in BC to deal with Alberta. The most famous example of this that I think most average people will run into at some point is you're not actually supposed to carry alcohol across the border. You're supposed to sell it back to your government, have that province sell it to the next province, and then you buy it from that province. Unfortunately, this deal has already put alcohol in a separate category that it might deal with later. So what are we trying to solve with this new internal trade deal?
Well, you hinted at one aspect, which is there's a lot of issues dealing with other provinces. Some of those are regulatory issues that can be as simple as when you're allowed to drive oversized loads on highways. BC and Alberta actually have different time requirements, so sometimes you have to stop at the provincial border and just wait several hours for you to be able to move on to the next province. There's different food labeling requirements. There's a whole bunch of different requirements that vary province to province. And it's a little unclear from the little bit of information that we've come out on this and how they're going to deal with those sorts of barriers. There's also stuff kind of like the alcohol issue that you mentioned where it's just you're not allowed to sell stuff across borders. Sometimes there's issues with procurements and kind of sourcing locally, which, you know, politicians love to do, but it's crappy economic policy. So some of those stuff still have to be negotiated. The Saskatchewan economy minister said they haven't made as much progress on some of those procurement issues that he would have liked to have seen. So there's still a lot to questions up in the air about. We're kind of talking about the story that we saw today that was this is going to be announced soon. We'll be waiting for more details. All I can really say is it's about damn time. The Constitution of 1867 laid out Canada as a free trade area among its members, and now it's 2017 and we're kind of finally getting around to solving this problem. It's one of those kind of national embarrassments that we've been lacking so long in dealing with this problem.
Yeah, the impetus seems to be the free trade agreements with Europe that Harper really kicked off, and the realization that if we have freer trade between BC and France and Alberta and Germany than we have between BC and Alberta, then something's broken. So full credit goes to Harper for getting this going, but more, I guess, even to Trudeau for really bringing it together and the premiers, because it looks like they're going to have this in effect for July 1st, which is also just a symbolic way to make it really nice. It's Canada's 150th, and on Canada Day, we become a freer trading nation.
In judicial news closer home, the BC Supreme Court has refused to hear the conflict of interest challenges regarding the premier's fundraising and stipend that we discussed last week. As we brought up at the time, the conflict of interest commissioner may have some conflicts of interest with the government, and the BC Supreme Court has refused to hear those challenges and considers the matter to be unreviewable.
These are cases brought forward by Democracy Watch, which is an advocacy group that's trying to reduce corruption. They said the decision by the Conflict of Interest Commissioner should be reviewed by the court. So they brought this petition to the BC Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's now ruled that they don't have the authority to review the Conflict of Interest Commissioners.
Yes, because the Conflict of Interest Commissioner, a report on this and decisions protected by legislative privilege, basically matters relating to the conduct of the legislature is kind of the sole purview of the legislature, and it's not really the position of the courts to kind of rule on their own internal processes, which, you know, there's a lot of good reasons for, but I think highlights the problem of having the Conflict of Interest Commissioner so closely bound to the legislature and not far enough off that it doesn't get covered by legislative privilege.
This is not even a decision. It doesn't exonerate the premier in any way. It also doesn't condemn her. It's just the court saying, they don't have the authority to even look at this question, which is really frustrating. Because as you're saying, the only person that does have the authority to look at whether the premier is in conflict of interest is the conflict of interest commissioner. And that would be okay if the position were trustworthy. But the only way we can make sure things are trustworthy is to have checks on them. And the courts are a nice check. It doesn't have to be the only way. But right now, the conflict of interest commissioner's word is the final say, it sounds like. And in this case, even when that person has direct connections to the premier and the premier's office and cabinet, there's no problem with this. So it just raises a lot of flags that there's no way forward, really.
Yes, I think this is going to be an issue that's going to keep dogging Christy Clark. But more importantly, to me, this says there need to be structural reforms with the conflict of interest commissioner's position. And perhaps, I'm just spitballing here, but maybe this should be a position that's moved outside of the legislature. And perhaps the commissioner should be appointed by, say, the chief justice of the province. You know, somewhere with enough standoff on the political realities of it that this doesn't become an issue. You know, and it's not out of the question for chief justices to appoint people. In fact, they are part of the appointing process for the Electoral Boundaries Commission. So why not for the conflict of interest position as well?
It's definitely going to be something that rolls into the election, because I guess that's the only check we have now. If the people get angry enough about this, they can throw the bums out and demand better. And hopefully the other parties start to put forward proposals to fix this. As you say, it's not that complicated. But let's shift gears now. Nanos has put out a new poll, as they do, and this one's finally shown that the Trudeau Liberals are now at 39% in the polls, which is actually where they were on the eve of the election. This is a big drop from the 48% high they were at in the last year, and really starts to paint the picture that maybe the honeymoon is over. This doesn't seem to be that much of an outlier poll. A lot of other reports are showing that the numbers have been sort of slowly trickling down for the Liberals, with most of that support actually going back and parking with the Conservatives.
Yeah, in fact, the Conservatives are actually at their 12-month high right now at 31.2%. And perhaps most interestingly, the party considered numbers, basically how many people would possibly vote Conservative, you know, what their vote ceiling is at the moment, has actually climbed quite a bit, up to 46.9%, which, by contrast, on the eve of the election was at 39%. So to me, this indicates that maybe kind of the Harper unpopularity and kind of the accumulated issues has faded away significantly, and that the concerns about they basically exhausted their reachable voters has passed, and a potentially reinvigorated party after this leadership race. I mean, it may turn out to be they come out divided, horrible person gets picked, and it all goes to hell. But, you know, they're definitely making gains, and they definitely look like they're going to be in a good position to contest the next election going forward.
Yeah, as I mentioned with that Ipsos poll back at the start of the show, with the right name recognition, O'Leary is putting the Conservatives in neck and neck with the Liberals. That doesn't mean that will turn out that way if he actually becomes leader, can't speak a lick of French, starts losing bleeding votes there, and
every bad thing he's ever said, which there's a lot of, come home to roost. And, you know, what I think would be hilarious is if he does win is the Liberals run the Just Visiting ads that the Conservatives did, but just swap the names out. There's a lot of potential weaknesses on some of the Conservative leadership candidates. We've talked a fair bit about O'Leary's, but many of the other leadership candidates also can't speak French very well. Someone like Kelly Leach, you probably lose the suburbs where a lot of the battle ridings are. And there's a good chance that Conservative Party led by Leach is hard to elect. But there's been enough uncertainty recently that nobody should be planning strategies around anyone being unelectable at this point.
Well, I'm sure you'll have more to tell us in a couple weeks. There's a Conservative Party leadership debate scheduled for February 18th, just out in Langley, a short drive.
Yeah, so we'll definitely be watching that. And if any of our local our listeners are kind of interested in what's happening in kind of federal politics, you know, a bit of it's come into our neck of the woods and maybe worth checking out. Last bit of domestic news today. There's a new report just released on the state of the Canadian news media, painting a somewhat bleak picture of declining revenues, declining number of media outlets, declining number of journalists, and offered some suggestions on what to do about it. Chief among those was basically create a multi-million dollar fund that gets used to subsidize the media industry. This fund would, in theory, be funded via a tax on non-Canadian online advertising. So basically, there'd be a 10% tax on any ads that aren't run through a Canadian service.
There was a lot of criticism for the consultations on this report and now on the recommendations, because it looks a lot like a lot of the old dinosaurs of Canadian media, the heads of Post Media, the heads of CTV and Global and Quebecor and Sun News, and a lot of, frankly, failing institutions going to the government with their hands out when they're also, especially Post Media, the same ones who've been attacking the government on literally everything they can for the past decade as they've sort of swung more and more to the right, especially on economic issues. So I love the irony of it, the sort of capitalist right-wing newspaper now having to beg for money and getting a report that says they should be given money. But in terms of the health of our democracy, a part of me does have a lot of sympathy for the Jesse Brown and Canada Land position of maybe it's time to just let the dinosaurs die and find ways to maybe invest in more nimble startups and different ideas. I will disclose, I do financially support Canada Land because I think they do good work. There are some good suggestions about CBC in there, about maybe taking ads off CBC, because why should the government-run media company be competing for ads with private corporations? It's just creating a weird standard.
Yes, and credit where credit is due. There's been some of the post-media columnists who've kind of stuck by their no subsidies, no bailout guns on this. Andrew Coyne, among others, has been pretty critical of any bailout, and even when potentially his job's on the line, him and a few of his colleagues are sticking to their guns. It's just a little disappointing to see the executives not take the same principled stance. But yeah, getting into the details of the report and the recommendations, there were some actually pretty good ideas in there. Some ones such as just extending the GST to cover online media, which made sense. You basically want to make the tax as broad as possible and not kind of carve out exemptions through lax enforcement or changes to the market landscape that kind of doesn't get captured just because the tax laws hasn't been updated in a while. So that's a pretty solid recommendation. I also like the idea of moving CBC's content to a Creative Commons license. Canadians are going to be shelling out $1 billion to support the CBC. You might as well be able to, you know, use the content in a more broader sense than we currently can. So there's some good stuff there. I have some reservations about the caps on ads and on the media fund they're planning on setting up.
And the issues that it will sort of strengthen the copyright issues. I know there's been a lot of criticism, particularly under the previous government, about how copyright kept becoming more and more restrictive, and that really limits what independent and new media artists and producers can do, because you can't remix things. We don't have the same freedom for fair use as they do in the States. There's different restrictions here. And so anything that strengthens copyright laws, I'm kind of skeptical of them, at least. But this is just a report. It's a bunch of recommendations. The government's been looking at media and how to fix it, because it is broken, to be honest. And maybe there's a chance they'll pick some of the good things up of this and leave the shit.
Yeah, one can hope. I'm not necessarily so confident that's going to be the case. It would not surprise me to see that the Liberals like the idea of kind of a media fund. However, there's a lot of kind of questions about how that would be going. I think a lot of problems with it in terms of how you decide who gets subsidies, should stuff be subsidized, because you're either in a situation where you're kind of subsidizing people like Rebel Media, which I don't think would be a good use of tax dollars, but at the other end you have concerns about a biased selection on how you go about it. Paul Wells, the columnist at the Toronto Star, had a suggestion that Justin Trudeau should appoint Pierre Poilievre as the head of this, because if he isn't willing to have someone as partisan as that running it, and, you know, it will be a matter of time. It might not be this government, but at some point in the future, people of partisan leanings will get appointed to this. You know, if he's not comfortable with having someone that partisan run it, it's probably not a good idea to have it. There's also the question of, as you said, a lot of these media companies are kind of dinosaurs, and should we be subsidizing them? And it is buoying up an inefficient company, really the best use of Canadian dollars. So I don't really see a good way here, because either you're picking winners or losers, or you're just throwing a whole bunch of money at kind of propping up unprofitable enterprises, neither of which are particularly good.
It's something we'll keep our eye on and probably delve more into in the future when it comes before Parliament, and this probably will result in a bill. But let's turn at last to a little bit of news out of the United Kingdom, where the final word has been brought down by the courts that, yes, if the UK is going to trigger Article 50 and leave the European Union, it will have to put that to a House of Commons vote, and it will have to pass, obviously. This isn't that surprising. This has sort of been a legal case that's been building up and has been made pretty clearly.
Everyone saw this coming, and it's not unexpected that, you know, in order to change the laws of the UK, you need the UK Parliament to vote on it, and that the referendum didn't have the legal authority to implement Article 5. It was legally merely an advisory opinion from the populace. So, naturally, you would actually have to bring it before a vote of the Commons. And the real question there is, are the MPs actually going to vote for Article 50?
Well, the Conservatives, who brought forward the referendum, have a majority in the House of Commons. And Theresa May, who was sort of pro-Remain before, has swung pretty hard to Brexit means Brexit. And so I see no hesitation on her part. I don't know how hard she's going to whip this vote. Even if she doesn't, Jeremy Corbyn, leader of Labour, has already started to say he's going to vote in favour of it. And he ran into a bit of controversy when he suggested he was going to whip Labour MPs into voting for it as well, and started to have big chunks of the party break ranks again to say, no, we're not. So it's a mess. The Lib Dems will vote against it, but they're a tiny third party at this point, and so Scottish National Party. I don't see the votes to stop this at this point.
And it is a nasty position to be in, because even if you're an MP and don't think you should be leaving the UK, it's kind of hard to overrule a clear mandate from the people on this, just from the political optics side of things. And in terms of UK Labour, yeah, I'm not surprised to see Corbyn come out against these. I would be more of an EU skeptic than the average Labour MP. And I think that's kind of a little unfortunate, but it does mean it's likely to pass, though the UK system is less whipped than the Canadian system is. There's more freedom for the individual MPs to kind of assert the interests of their constituents. They don't always vote down pure party lines, kind of the way we do in Canada. So it may be a lot more messy than just the raw numbers in terms of who holds what seat will suggest.
The referendum itself wasn't that clear. It was a 52% vote, which once you say it's 52% of the fraction that turned out to vote, which was not a huge voter turnout. It wasn't 90% of people turned out. Questions become a lot more muddy. So it'll be an ongoing issue and controversy. I don't expect it to fail. It's frustrating. I'd love to see the UK stay in Europe. It's the only thing that would make sense, but it's going to get dragged out and it's going to continue to hamper the British economy. It's going to continue to put a lot of uncertainty into Europe, and it's going to fuel a lot more racial tensions in Britain. And I think it's going to continue to reignite Scottish separatism, which we haven't heard much of in the last little bit. But once Article 50 is triggered, I can't imagine it will be long before another Scottish independence referendum is coming up to say, but not us. And they try to opt themselves out of it. So interesting times in the UK, but not really fun ones.
Yeah, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on what's shaping up to be quite a messy, drawn-out fight. And that has been Politikos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politikos.ca. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at politikospod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.